Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 39 of the Chills of Will podcast. It is a pleasure today to be joined by the talented poet, talented writer, Jose Hernandez Diaz. Jose Hernandez Diaz is a 2017 NEA Poetry Fellow. He holds degrees in English and creative writing from the University of California at Berkeley, Go Bears, and Antioch University, Los Angeles. He's the author of the chapbook of prose poems, The Fire Eater, which was published in 2020 through Texas Review Press, and he has been awarded a fellowship by the National Endowment for the Arts. He lives in Southern California. About his chapbook, The Fire Eater, Felicia Somora, who is the author of Instrument of Gaps, wrote, "In these homages to humanity, Jose Hernandez Diaz weaves magic and duality, a conjuring of metamorphosis from unknowing to understanding. These lines invent themselves as a circuitous way of thinking, a non-linear way of experiencing. We stand on the precipice of fire in Hernandez Diaz's poems. We inhabit a place where orange roses burst into flames, preachers transform into pigeons, flames walk among us and turn to ash. We are simultaneously dragon and coyote, and we're seeing the stars from the moon speaks to the delicacy of our sparks, our actions, our bones. A world exists in these poems where eating fire may be our only skill, but the scars on our, quote, autumnal hearts prove we were here, prove we were a part of it all, prove that we believe the flames may one day be ours to wield." Hernandez Diaz creates a multidimensional existence, one where Latinx artists may, quote, dream about existence beyond the clouds, unquote, an existence filled with part wonder, part pain, but most importantly, part possibility. That's a pretty dang good review you got from Felicia Somora, huh?
It's perfect.
Yeah. How do you know her? Or how did you work with her?
I just know her through publishing in journals, and and I would see her name all the time. Mm-hmm. And she won the Montoya Prize a couple years ago. And I reached out to her and I told her I was a fan of her work and if she would read it and write a blurb for us. She said, yeah.
That's awesome. Well, she's a heck of a writer. Just based on that review, I want to go read some of her stuff.
Yes, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Officially welcome. Thanks so much for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you. Hey, how'd I do on the intro? Is there anything else you want to add?
No, that's perfect.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, a pleasure to have you. And I've had writers of all types, poets, sports writers, journalists. And I know you're not just a, you know, prose poet, not just a surrealist poet, but I'm really looking forward to talking about surrealism and prose poetry.
Definitely.
Tell me a little bit about growing up. You grew up in LA, in the LA area?
Yeah, I grew up in Buena Park, which is Northern Orange County.
Right.
And then when I was 14, we moved to Norwalk, which is Southeast LA County. So I kind of go back and forth all the time. So.
Sure. Buena Park is right there by, is that Knott's Berry Farm?
Yeah, yeah.
So growing up in, you know, I say LA kind of generically, North Orange County, et cetera. What were you reading? You know, did you grow up speaking English and Spanish, or are you monolingual, or?
Yeah, no, we grew up speaking Spanish in the household. Our parents are from Mexico, but I tend to be in, I'm in the younger sibling group.
Okay.
So my older siblings were already speaking English to us. Mm-hmm. So they grew up more like mostly only Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with my siblings speaking English to me already.
Okay.
So I kind of grew up with both.
Sure.
Yeah, but they did place me like in the ESL and initially, and then they took me out. Mm. Yeah.
What did you gain from being bilingual, speaking Spanglish, Spanish? You know, what do you gain from having being multilingual?
Well, it's sort of a window into a different culture.
Sure.
There's a little more flavor to it, I think. But growing up in Orange County, which is kind of like a conservative area, even Northern Orange County, which is more like on the outskirts of the working class, people tended to speak English on the street. And then at home, we would speak Spanish. That's kind of how it was over there. And I noticed when we moved over here to Norwalk, it was like mostly Spanish in and out of the house. Sure. So it was kind of like a little confusing, I think, when you're younger, you know, learning to manage all of that. And also, I would mostly speak English, honestly. And I tended to lose the fluidity with my Spanish, except like if I go to Mexico or something, and then it just comes out naturally. Back, and nice. You have to practice it more, obviously. So
nice.
Yeah.
What part of Mexico do your parents come from?
They're from ranches in Guanajuato, Mexico.
Okay. Do you write in Spanish? Have you written in Spanish?
When I used to read like Octavio Paz and a lot of the modernist writers from the last century, I would have to read like a lot in Spanish. And then I would start writing in Spanish like decently, not like, it would be more fractured, like surrealistic, like Octavio Paz.
Okay.
But no, I was never trained to write in Spanish or anything like that. It's more just by ear.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in The Fire Eater really that much, if at all. Do you sprinkle in Spanglish?
Or yeah, well, like I was telling you earlier, my manuscript is divided into two sections, my full length. This is the chapbook is the second half, and that's just surreal prose poetry. And back then when I was writing surreal prose poetry, I tended to just be in English and not really, it was more like influenced by the Midwestern poets like James Tate and Russell Edson.
Okay.
I would write about just everyday things and American things.
Uh-huh.
But lately, like I have one called El Sombrero, a prose poem where I mix in more Spanish, but it does tend to be sprinkled in. It's not like elaborate, you know?
Sure.
And also in my more identity-based Chicano poems, I do sprinkle it in a lot more in there too.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, we could probably do 3 hours on this question alone, but
yeah.
Do you, you know, like in the review I read, you know, it talked about Latinx and you say Chicano. Would you consider yourself to be Mexicano, Chicano, Latinx, all of the above?
I think all of the above and at different moments sometimes, you know, I just call myself Mexican American, you know, I used to, when I was younger, I'd call myself Chicano. Sometimes I just wouldn't even think about it, you know, growing up. But now I would say Mexican American.
What culture, what books, what movies, what songs, what were your parents, what did your family bring to you as a child? Like, you know, what were you into because of them?
We kind of grew up like just like tradition, like everyday American type movies, you know, The Sandlot and things like that. The Spanish we would watch sometimes would be like the novelas that they would watch, but I didn't understand half of it, but it was like, you know, those beautiful women on there.
Yeah, right.
And so I think the biggest thing is like the food. That's something that to this day is like, we pretty much stick to Mexican food. I think that's maybe one of the most important parts that has been handed down, I think.
What were you reading as a kid? What were your interests like? Who were some of the writers or genres or books, you know, poetry, etc., that got you into writing, that got you excited about literature?
Well, as a kid, I was mostly on the street playing basketball, honestly.
Nice.
I was into the Lakers and Nick Van Exel and Eddie Jones, Cedric Sabalas. I was like before they had Shaq and Kobe.
Sure.
So I was mostly playing basketball. I thought I was going to go to the NBA, all that stuff. And then I got to high school and the coach is like, you got no left dribble. Like, I just do the right dribble, you know, like this, like street ball. I never played in a league or anything like that. We couldn't afford any of that stuff. And then he said, but you're good at football. You're a starter, you know, so just focus on football. So I was just playing football. And then I got to my junior year of English. And my high school teacher, Mrs. Weir, said, you know, you're getting a D in my class, and your test scores are coming out that you're, you know, they're very high, the test scores. So I want you to try harder and read more. And like, this is the first time somebody really like said like I was good at school, you know? So it was like, well, I was in honors in elementary and stuff like that, but I just cared about sports mostly, you know?
Sure.
I remember I was in honors in junior high, and most of the students there were like nerdy and stuff. So I told my mom, it's too hard. Can you sign me out of these classes? I didn't know that, you know, that was like, that could potentially damage my future, you know? So yeah, I was signed out all the honors classes and stuff.
Yeah.
My parents did not really know what's going on, you know, like they did not really have education, opportunity for education. So this teacher says that, and then I just feel like a million bucks, you know, like, oh, I'm good at language, you know? So I started reading like Salinger. I think that's the book that spoke to me at first. Everything else before that was like Shakespeare and it just sounded so like a long time ago, you know, for some low income kids, you know, first generation, like, it's just like, I'm not going to get into these plays, you know, like, I like the idea of he was saying everything was phony and this and that, you know. Right. I know everybody hates it now, the book. A lot of people hate it, but I just remember I also liked that it was written like in everyday language, you know. And I was just, it just spoke to me in the sense that like it could be considered literature and still be in everyday language.
Shout out your teacher. You said it was a Mrs. Weir?
Mrs. Weir.
I've seen on social media that you said something about you send her the journals when you get published.
Now and then, yeah.
That's really cool. That is so cool that you do that. I bet she loves that. What was some of the first writing you did that kind of raised some eyebrows in a positive way? Like, okay.
I remember it was an essay that she assigned about the American dream and just like what I thought about the American dream. Is it possible? What do I want in my future? You know?
Sure.
And I just started like quoting Rage Against the Machine, like that one song that goes, what was it? The American dream is hypocrisy, brutality. I think I chose like three things, like hypocrisy, brutality, the elite, I think. I wrote all of which are American dreams. I kind of plagiarized them at the end of the essay, honestly. I was like, well, that's how I ended it. All of which are American dreams, all of which are American. So I don't know if she probably didn't know that song, but I remember that, like, she was like, wow, this is really good. And also at Berkeley, I was sort of having trouble getting into like older literatures, you know, and like the classics and stuff like that. And my professor, Mrs. Langan, assigned us to write sonnets. And I was like, wow, I have to write like in a scheme and it has to rhyme and all that stuff. Yeah. So what I did was like, I wrote it with like sort of sticking to those rules, but sort of like criticizing those rules at the same time.
Oh, okay.
So nice. I was kind of like, I think I was sort of, what's the word, like a contrarian when I was younger.
So you were shaped by tradition, but you were also not afraid to go against it and criticize it. I want to say, I think the song you're talking about, I think is Wake Up. Isn't that the one from the Matrix?
Yeah, I think it is. I haven't seen it, but I think that it was like not on an album. It was on the Matrix soundtrack.
I mean, the end of that song is like you said, all of which are American dreams. So you should be paying royalties to Zach De La Roca, I guess, huh?
Yeah. I know. I just got one picked up yesterday that I have the Man in the Pink Floyd shirt, and now I started a new series with the Man in a Rage Against the Machine shirt.
Nice.
So, like, So.
Yeah, what a great band. I just think about what if they were still – I mean, I know, like, Tom Morello does his own thing.
Yeah.
Great music. I just wonder if that group was together in times of all this ridiculous upheaval and, you know, Trumpism and all that, they would be – they'd be incredible.
Especially the Yeah, especially the last 4 years.
Right? That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I saw them in 2010 or so. They got together and they did a fundraiser for Dolores Huerta, the labor organizer.
Yeah.
That was pretty incredible. But yeah. Anyways, we won't talk about them for too long.
No, they got roots in the whole movement stuff. I think his parents were like muralists, or his dad was a muralist.
Right.
His mom was like a professor, educator.
They go way back, no doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. But yeah, I appreciate the fact that I thought I was going to be an NBA player, and then you get to a certain point, it's like, oh, maybe I got to do something else.
Yeah.
You know, I do something else. Yeah. Tell me about Berkeley, how else you were shaped there and your experience at Cal Berkeley.
Well, Berkeley, I just love the whole idea of independent thinking. Mm-hmm. When I was younger, especially, I was into rock and roll and underground hip hop. And I was listening more to MF Doom when I was in college, and Anacon and Def Jux and different underground rappers, instead of reading, So I would get by. I would write essays, get by, but I was not really a good student, I don't think, Mm-hmm. It took me a while to finish my degree.
Sure.
I was diagnosed with bipolar. So I took a non-traditional path to acquiring my degrees, mm-hmm. because I also was a transfer student.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay. Yeah.
So pretty horrible to hear about MF Doom's death.
Yeah. Yeah, that's surprising.
I know a little bit. I can't say that I'm an expert. What was it about his stuff that spoke to you?
I think it was the non sequiturs, the art of that, the collage. He brings you to New York City just with mundane imagery, and that's, I've always been a fan of that, whether it's New York school poetry in terms of Dean Young or something, So okay. I've always just been a fan of little moments being big, I think.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into the idea of the non sequitur and logic or lack of in some of your poetry later on. Let's get to, your writing and your published writing. Not that the Fire Eater is the end all be all. What have you had published in smaller ways before that? I know that's a collection. What led you to say, hey, I can actually publish my writing and people are going to read it and people are going to, pay me, whether it's with contributor copies or money. What led you to that?
I think first of all was reading a lot of spending time at the library, and I remember one time a professor wrote something about SB 1070 for a professor I had from Berkeley, and I said, I want to write a poem about that, and it was called The Border Within, and I published it in Poets Responding to SB 1070, which is an online group. We weren't getting paid or anything like that, but we felt we were resisting against xenophobia, etc. And then I got a message that it was going to get published in the Best American Non-Required Reading, and that was my second publication ever,
Wow.
So I was wow. And I've never been published in there ever, since then.
Uh-huh.
Or in any other of the Best American series.
Wow.
I could tell that I was, I was pretty good at it, because I wasn't really good at much else. So yeah, I think that's mainly when you see your name in print the first couple times, you see it attached to a university or something like that, and an MFA program, you feel like everything was worth it,
Right.
Yeah.
Man, heck of a debut if you got into the Best American Non-Required Reading. That's incredible. Wow. Could we find that piece online, or is it only in print? Or
it's only in print. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's in awesome. The 2011 edition.
2011 is nice.
10 years ago, yeah.
Nice. The name of the podcast is the Chills at Will podcast. It's about those lines, those excerpts that bring you chills, that Rage Against the Machine line, something that you could just summon from memory, I mean, you talked about a little bit with Salinger and stuff. Who and what were some of those pieces that have given you chills at will over the years?
Well, I think I remember when I first started reading poetry, it was Francisco Alarcón.
Okay.
From the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
He has a book called Snake Poems, and they just spoke to me. They were written in a thin line. Mm-hmm. And they were about being Chicano and American and Mexican and everything like that. So I've had like different writers speak to me at different times. I'm not good with like coming off lines off the top of my head. Ray Gonzalez, Richard Garcia,
okay,
Marosa de Giorgio, Octavio Paz. I think Octavio Paz is the main one.
Yeah.
I went to the library and I saw his book there, and you know, I read that he won the Nobel and everything. And I never knew a Mexican had ever won the Nobel.
Huh.
And I just started reading him, and there was, you know, it was quick, and he juxtaposed things, and it was surreal, and it was about the city and everyday life. And so I just liked like the collage aspect to it. And so yeah, different writers have spoke to me.
What was the, so you said Francisco Alarcón, right?
Yes.
Francisco
X Alarcón. He actually taught at Davis.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of writers with that last name. There's Daniel Alarcón. I was thinking him, but you said Francisco. Yes. Octavio Paz, like I was a Spanish major in college. And so we did Cinco Maestros, which is an anthology of like the five of the greatest in Spanish.
Right.
Garcia Marquez, Rulfo, I think Cortazar. I don't think Paz made it in there. I mean, obviously he is one of the greatest, but Borges, Borges, exactly. Paz obviously wrote more shorter pieces, right? This was more short stories and stuff. Surrealism is his thing. People think of like Salvador Dali, you know, with the painting and stuff. What is surrealism to you? I mean, I know there's a dry definition that I could read. What is it about Paz's work, you know, that led into you writing often and with surrealism? What does it mean to you?
I think it's just about working with the imagination, the subconscious, and sort of digging in there and writing things you didn't expect, and like the creative in creative writing, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So it could be a number of things. It's not something that needs to be defined in a exact way, I think, you know. Okay. I think it's freedom, you know. I think it's a free line.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about like being a contrarian and stuff growing up. I think a lot of us are in those ways. It's not necessarily a bad thing, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds like, I mean, surrealism is pretty broad. Like the rules are not like narrow for that. You feel like there's a pretty broad definition of what that is.
I think for someone to say, this is surreal. Like if they wrote a poem, they said, this is surreal. Mm-hmm. I would probably look for things like unusual things, things that were maybe not consistent with reality.
Sure.
Maybe dreamlike.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. In reading on the history of surrealism and stuff, it talks about it was kind of invented, not invented, but put a name to by like a French guy.
Yeah.
Breton, I want to say.
Yeah.
World War I, World War II. Like I get it, right? The world was an ugly place.
Yeah.
You could argue it always is or still is, but something about they kind of wanted to like mimic what the world was like. The world wasn't logical, right? The world didn't make sense.
Yeah.
That kind of fit in there. But you know, there's Paz, there's Dali, you know, Paz is Latino, Dali is Spanish. Have you seen in your reading that in your reading that surrealism is, there's a very specific surrealism in Latin America or in Spanish speaking countries, or is it more broad?
No, I'm actually not really an expert on that, on terms of like the differences. And
I don't
really even read like the French one. I tend to read the American ones in English, you know,
okay.
But I'm not really an expert in terms of like the differences and things like that. Yeah.
Have you read Marquez? Have you read Isabel Allende, like magical realism?
Yeah, I had to read it in undergraduate, but I've always had trouble with reading long novels, like the attention thing. So that's why poetry, I always excelled at it, because it was like, you know, 1 minute, you read it, you're done, you know?
Right.
So novels, like to this day, I have trouble reading novels. Like,
Same.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So in reading, you have one, I think it's literally called like a walk on the moon? You have two pieces about the moon. I think it's called a walk, right? And one of them literally starts off, the first sentence is a man woke up on the floor of the moon or on the surface of the moon.
Yeah.
And so like, that's what I know of like magical realism, is that like that first sentence, I'm like, okay, cool. like I suspend disbelief, you know, like I wouldn't right. normally think a person could wake up on the moon, but it's just like, okay, yeah. cool. You know, next, like, interesting. Yeah. So I get, that was cool because, you know, I don't have too much of a history in surrealism, but in reading your work, I'm thinking of like magical realism.
Yeah. I think they both are like interchangeable, honestly. Okay. I know there might be some professor that would say, oh no, this, and you know, but
sure.
to me, it's like, I think they're similar. Yeah. You know, they would describe unusual things in ordinary language mm-hmm. as if they were everyday occurrence, you know? So that, yeah. I caught my professor telling me that. But uh-huh. at the same time, like, I didn't read the novel, you know, I was out being a dumb kid, you know? So maybe I'll go back to it later.
Yeah.
But so yeah, when I was doing there with the moon, and I was just trying to write things that were interesting mm-hmm. and see how far I could take it with the bizarre and try to present it in a way that was like nonchalant and this is real. Of course it's real. Why not? Yeah. You know?
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I don't want to get too bogged down on labels. I'm the same. It's like, whatever, if it's good, it's good writing, and yours is definitely good writing, yeah. then whatever the label. Talking about the Fire Eater, what led to that? What was kind of the background on that? What's, you know, where'd the title come from, and where did a lot of the inspiration for it come from?
That's a great question. I remember my family supports me. They help me out a lot. You know, I've taken a non-traditional path. I've got fired for fighting and all kinds of, I've got suspended, all kinds of stuff. They always supported me with, like, you know, I would always have a plate on the table at least. But I remember one time I asked my mom, I said, do you believe that I'm going to make it as a writer and, you know, a teacher and things like that? And she was like, no. I said, really? She said, yeah. I said, I've won an NEA fellowship, you know? And they're like, that's not enough money. I was like, oh my God, you know? That's when I created the character of the Fire Eater who his family had just abandoned him and he would have to make it on his own. Uh-huh. And that's why he was shooting fire on Hollywood Boulevard, trying to get someone to discover him, huh. sort of the way that I'm trying to do, you know?
Sure. Oh, well, that's really interesting. Yeah. I love the honesty there. No.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's the Mexican mom right there for you. Yeah.
So, you know, I could sit down and I could write all these non sequiturs. I could write all these lines that don't make sense. I could talk about the podium to my right. I could talk about El Alfabeto in back of me and some random books, but it wouldn't sound as good. It wouldn't be as good as yours. It wouldn't be, you know, award-winning poetry. How do you put these nonsensical, unconnected, disconnected things together to make the work that you do?
That's a great question. I think in the underlying, in the glue of the poetry, it has to be beautiful. Mm-hmm. It has to be lyrical. There has to be other things that are traditionally called poetry, alliteration.
Sure.
Maybe a subtle rhyme at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the sound has to do with it. Because you're right. I have some where I try to just write nonsense and not, I'm like, no, you know? I want it to sound beautiful, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I want it to sound like poetry, like Lorca, you know? So I want it to sound like it's still beautiful. It's not just rubbish, you know?
Sure. So talking about sound, I mean, do you practice in front of the mirror? Do you record it on your phone? Do you workshop with, you know, your mom or your friends? Or like, how do you get the sound down?
I think the sound and meter and all that is like, I listen to a lot of music, you know, growing mm-hmm. up. Also, I remember 2014, I was having trouble getting in the bigger magazines. And I took some time off of Antioch
mm-hmm.
and I just started reading, like, I think I read 100 books that year. That's what I say. It might have been a little more, a little less. So I was just like, you know, I had no social life. I was just like, I didn't buy any new clothes or anything like that. I was a minimalist. That's another thing that has guided me throughout this process is being a minimalist and living like this. So I think when you read so much, you pick up an ear for it.
Oh, that's a great way to describe it. Right. You can hear it when you read it, even if you're not speaking out loud. That makes a lot of sense. And that's cool too. I was looking for the right word. You know, I was going to be like economy of language, but like minimalist really.
That's true too. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, minimalism really describes it.
Yeah.
You know, like a Hemingway or something like that was known for economy of language.
Yeah.
And where the sentences may be isolated are fairly minimalist, but together they just, you know, what do they say? The sum is worth more than the parts, that kind of thing. Well, I wonder if we could maybe get into some, talk about a couple of the poems from.
Okay. Harry. Any requests or?
How about Cuauhtémoc Hoxh? Help me with the Nahual.
Xochipilli.
Right. Soch, like Xochil. Okay.
Yeah.
Xochipilli. You've got. Well,
I said it wrong too.
I want to talk. Yes. Yeah. I want to talk about it after. I got some really interesting, I thought there's some really interesting stuff. And if you wouldn't mind sharing that, that'd be great.
Okay. Here it is. Cuauhtémoc Xochipilli. A jaguar sat in a tree. It was midsummer. The sun was shining fiercely. The jaguar was a golden color with plenty of brown spots. Then the ghost of Emiliano Zapata walked by. He was in full uniform with rifle and sword, but in black and white. He looked like a cloud. The jaguar leapt from the tree and walked up to Zapata's ghost. The jaguar genuflected in General Zapata's direction. Zapata pulled out his sword and knighted the jaguar. From this day forward, this noble jaguar will be called Cuauhtémoc Xochipilli, he said. The sun faded and set. It began to rain.
And that was, so obviously you can see there, I'm glad I was able to put it up on the screen. It's from the Poetry Foundation. Was this like a like poem of the day type of thing, or how did this end up on their website?
No, they publish you in print and online.
Oh, okay. I know Cuauhtémoc was, you know, was a huge name in the Aztec Empire.
Right.
What's the importance of the name Xochipilli, and why did you name it as you did?
He's the flower god and the god of the arts.
Okay.
And I wanted it to have a warrior name, but also, you know, artistic side to it.
Nice. Yeah. Like that contrast between the two. You know, Zapata, of course, is a huge name in Mexican history. Yeah. I don't know if you saw, you know, all those Bernie Sanders memes yesterday.
Yeah, those were hilarious. Yeah,
and there was a great one where he, you know, that famous picture where it's Pancho Villa and Zapata and all the.
Oh yeah.
He, you know, of course Bernie was in that one. That was one of my favorites.
Oh yeah.
You know, of course, with the great handlebar mustache, and Zapata was known as being like for the people and the Zapatistas and the working for the, you know. So why Zapata? Why the ghost of Zapata? Why not, you know, some other person?
I just think that, you know, since I was a kid growing up in Northern Orange County, listening to Rage Against the Machine, they had a shirt that said Rage Against the Machine and it had Zapata on there.
I remember that.
Always wear it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was always proud of it because I felt like I looked like him. You know, I was dark skinned. A lot of my siblings are lighter than me. I think I'm probably the darkest one.
Uh-huh.
I have a sister that's also like me. And so I just related to him and his cause, and I just felt he's very noble.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always sort of like admired him, and that's why I threw him in the poem.
I wonder if I'm an English teacher, so we break down poetry, et cetera, and, you know, close reads and all that.
Right.
I wonder if me in this case, or do you ever get people who you feel like, hey, come on, man, like who overread or read too much into a poem?
Sometimes, but there's a lot in there sometimes too. So,
okay. You know, so I'm looking at, you know, I think you do a great job painting the image of Zapata knighting the jaguar.
Right.
And I know, you know, one of Zapata's lines was like, "Es más vale morir en las
pies."
Sí.
Yeah, yeah.
En que morir en las rodillas, algo
knees.
Así.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Right. The idea it's better to die on your die on your feet than live.
That's
on
what the back of my shirt said.
Is that right?
Yeah, in high school. Yeah.
Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah. So. Why the jaguar? Why that particular animal?
Well, the jaguar is a sacred animal in Mexico. So specifically the southern region. So I have a lot of jaguar poems actually. Yeah.
Yeah, I was able to see one in Cancun area in Mexico, southern Mexico, like you talked about. I think it's huge with the Mayan people as well.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. Or maybe you want to resist. What if someone said to you, how would you sum up this piece in a sentence? Or would you be like, that's not what it's about?
You could do that too, if you wanted to.
I want the answer. Can you tell me the answer? What's this poem about in one sentence? That's for me to figure out, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Okay. But I don't know about, I never liked the idea of like, what's a poem about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's various things going on, and it's just about honoring Mexico and my culture, my heritage, you know, mm-hmm. creating like a little story that, you know, I think a lot of poetry is like, I'm Mexican, I'm poor, you know, I grew up in a bad neighborhood, and I have those poems too, you know,
mm-hmm.
I have plenty of those poems too, but like, this allows me to like, create another world and mixing my heritage with like surrealism and
that's cool
and just making a little story out of it, you know.
Nice. Yeah, I love the idea of you definitely create your own world, and it's a great world. And yeah, that makes a lot of sense, the idea of like the reverence for the culture, genuflecting and the knighting and the golden colors and all of that, and of course that regal animal, which is the jaguar. That's cool. How about the longboard?
Oh, actually, that one, I have it in the book, and I sold out of copies.
I say, I won't do justice to it, but can I read it? Is that all right?
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. And I was going to ask you about it because it's one of those where we were talking before we started recording, you know, someone like Sherman Alexie, would say what you want about the personal life, but writer.
Right.
And we were talking about how some of his work comes off at like, I think of his story called Indian Education.
Right.
Each grade, there's a line that like sums it up, and it's almost like inspirational, but not cheesy. And I know as an amateur writer, like that's not easy to do. I always feel like it comes off cheesy. And I feel like he did the same thing where you have this positivity, this inspiration, but it's not forced. It's not cheesy. So
thank you.
I'm looking at your awesome cover here of the Fire Eater, and I got the longboard ready to go. Here's the longboard. A man rode a longboard in downtown Los Angeles. It was overcast in the city. He listened to Gary Clark Jr. on his headphones as he rode. He wore his favorite Dodgers jersey. He was not going anywhere specifically. He just liked riding his longboard in the city. He rode through the USC campus. He smoked a cigarette. The metro howled in the distance. He saw a few seagulls overhead. As Gary Clark Jr. played a hypnotic guitar into his ear, he felt as if he were flying and everything were okay. Nothing could stop him now. And, you know, the last line is great. Nothing could stop him now. But I even like he felt as if he were flying and everything were okay. Not forced, but like positive and inspirational. What was your, what was the inspiration for the longboard?
The longboard? Well, I grew up riding the longboard. I couldn't stand on the regular skateboard. I would like fall down, you know. And my friends grew up skateboarding, so I would just ride the longboard like for transportation,
mm-hmm.
especially when I moved out here initially. I would park in the back of the apartments and
sure.
I would just ride the longboard, you know, and try to avoid people. And, you know, there's probably like 4 or 5 gangs in this neighborhood. I sort of just try to avoid people with it. Now I'm comfortable. Like, you know, I walk around everywhere and stuff like that.
Sure.
I went to a soccer game with my brother-in-law in LA at the LAFC, and we were on the metro and stuff. And I'm like a suburban kid. I don't really use the train, you know. After I rode the train and was like in the city, in USC and stuff, walking past there, I wrote like maybe 5-6 poems the next day. Like it's sort of inspired by that.
Nice.
Yeah, and that's where it came in.
Is there something about the longboard, like the kind of, is like that freedom, that independence?
Oh yeah, definitely. Right. Yeah.
Put your headphones in.
Yeah. Just when I was younger, especially now I'm like working and busy doing things.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was younger, like it just, there was a freedom, you know, and no one could mess with you. And, it was part of your identity, I think, mm-hmm. you know, and sort of being like the new generation of Mexican Americans.
That's cool.
Freedom.
I kind of wish I would have, when I was about 3 or 4, my neighbor took me out on the skateboard. He was like 15. I was too young. I fell. I got hurt. I never skateboarded again. I wish I would have. You were talking about writing 5 or 6 poems a day after that soccer game and seeing the metro and all that. So it's a good transition into, you know, what's your inspiration in general? Do you like, you know, do you go out into nature kind of thing, or, and also kind of like, what's your schedule on a daily basis? Do you like, all right, I'm going to write, you know, for 2 hours every day or 500 words, or are you kind of just like whenever it happens?
Yeah, no, I'm more like play it by ear. Not really. Every day is different.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm in a writing mood or spell,
mm-hmm.
I could go like a month writing every day, you know? maybe not a month consecutively, but
sure,
like Poetry Month last year, I probably wrote like 50 poems.
Wow.
And published like half of them or something like that. So it was very productive.
So you got this April coming up. You got to get more than 50, huh?
I know, but I'm going to be teaching a class too. So,
oh, all right.
In the Poetry Month. So
yeah.
Prose poetry class. Yeah.
Oh, nice. So yeah. when you're writing, are you rocking Rage Against the Machine, MF Doom, or are you rocking like Beethoven or something?
I wrote one the other day. And it was MF Doom beats, but Rage Against the Machine, I tended to listen to when I was younger. I don't really listen to it anymore, honestly. But so it's a little heavy for me now, you know, I'm an old man. In terms of, I got to take care of my ears, you know, my hearing.
There you go.
But I'm still down with like the whole imagery and everything. So, but yeah, when I write, sometimes it's beats, but most of the time it's just like the middle, like 5 o'clock in the morning and coffee, no food yet. Just cause I sort of have like insomnia. So in terms of, I wake up early and, I think it's a side effect of my medication, honestly. So it kind of works out for the writing and stuff like that. Sure. And the editing and being productive when it's quiet. So,
yeah. So is this your first time teaching or you've been teaching for a while?
It's going to be my first time. Yeah.
Nice. Has quarantine been, I mean, it sounds like you've been pretty productive in quarantine since the COVID.
Yeah. Even before that, I was like an introvert and I would just go to the library and work there, edit from there. But now I see that I need even the library, you know, and getting out every day because it's a bit much now.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. It's a little too much.
Especially in LA.
Shoot. Yeah.
I know you got a lot of poems that are being published coming up.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, quick aside too. I mean, we've talked about it and I think it's fairly self-explanatory, but you write prose poetry, prose is basically anything that's more like paragraphs and sentences rather than like Shakespeare's type poetry.
Verse, which is more like line break and stanzas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We obviously heard it in the pieces from you. Yeah. So I know you got a lot being published coming out soon. What else are you working on? Are you trying to collect them into another, you know, chapbook? What do you got coming
up? So right now I have the chapbook that came out 1 year ago and then the full length, which is some of those poems from the chapbook and then poems about my life growing up and my family, a lot of homages to my family and my parents, their sacrifice as immigrants and just as parents, you know, to my grandparents and my siblings. That's what the first half of the book is about, more like family and identity. And then the second half is the surrealist aspect. And that was just the finalist for the National Poetry Series. So
congratulations. I'm
excited about that. Thank you.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
So hopefully that gets picked up. And then after that, I have like a whole nother, like, at least the full length, you know, that's done. Like what I've been writing last year and today, you know, this year. So I have at least like one and a half or something more.
Have family and friends, a lot of your family and friends read your work?
It's tough to say. I mean, maybe they have, but nobody really says anything about it.
What are you going to try to get across to your students when you become a teacher, when you become a professor?
Figure that out when it happens, like when I write the poems, you know, like of course I'll prepare and everything like that, but I think I'll just go into the history of the prose poem and the different styles of prose poems, the absurd ones, the surreal ones. There's some that are more autobiographical, political, so there's different styles. And then in terms of getting started, I think we're gonna like pick words and try to improvise from there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Can you, let's end with you maybe shouting out one or two. Who's somebody writing right now, 2021, whatever genre, who you're really into?
I'm really into Michael Torres. He's from Pomona, California.
Okay.
He has a book that just came out, won the National Poetry Series last year. It's called An Incomplete List of Names. And I know he teaches like in the prisons and also in University of Minnesota. And also Felicia Zamora, I think, who we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
She's just prolific, and she's nice. Going to be teaching at Cincinnati this upcoming semester.
Awesome, man. Again, thanks again for introducing me to, I'm not introducing me, but really getting me interested in prose poetry, but more so surrealist poetry. I really enjoyed reading it. Wishing you great luck in the future, and thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again, everybody, for listening to episode 39 of the Chills of Will podcast with Jose Hernandez Diaz. You can now subscribe to the Chills of Will podcast on Apple Podcasts. Please leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find the pod on Spotify and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills of Will podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will P-O-1. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation that I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills of Will podcast is Wind Down, instrumental version. And the other song played on the episode is Hoops, instrumental by Matt Whitehour. And both songs are used through archesaudio.com. For now, thanks again for listening. And I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills. Texts like the Fire Eater, writers with mad skills like Jose Hernandez Diaz, whose work gives you chills at will.